I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about ways that we might make elections more competitive and Indiana's political process more reflective of the state and its citizens. We'll look at ways to empower citizens and enhance their voices in the creation of public policy. My guests are Tom Sugar of LeadOrLeave.org, Julia Vaughn of Common Cause Indiana, and Robert Dion, political science professor with the University of Evansville. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is wfyi. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are going to be talking today about ways that we can make the political process and the process of crafting public policy more responsive and reflective of the state and its citizens. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Joining me today for this conversation are Tom Sugar, who is with LeadOrLeave.org, Julia Vaughn, who is with Common Cause. They're both with me here in the studio, and joining us by phone from Evansville is Robert Dion, who is with the Political Science Department of the University of Evansville. Welcome to all of you.
Good to be with you, John.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you all here. Well, I'm going to start, this is one of those subjects that, most people, when you start talking about gerrymandering or you start talking about maps and all of that, you can literally almost see their eyes roll back into their heads. And they don't quite get why this is as important as it is. So make the case real quickly for why we should pay attention to this. Tom's pointing at Julia.
I'm going to jump in here, John, if you don't mind, because I got a quick story to tell on
sure.
that. And I'm sure Julia's had this experience too. When you travel around and you meet with members of the media and you meet with opinion leaders and elected officials and you make the case for what's broken and what we need to do about it, you're right. There's a lot of folks that go, yeah, Tom, well, that's a bunch of process. You know, people just don't get that. But, John, honestly, I think there's a huge gulf between what we think people understand and what they actually do understand. I was at the bank recently doing some banking for my organization, LeadOrLeave, and the 30-year-old bank manager who sat across the desk from me looked at the logo on my check and goes, LeadOrLeave, what's that all about? And within 2 minutes of describing to her what it was about, you know, that politicians today choose their voters instead of the other way around, a simple, direct conversation about it, she slammed her fist on the table and she said, that's why I don't vote. Because it feels to me like my vote doesn't count anymore and that the outcomes of elections are almost predetermined. And so I don't believe it. I think people know something is badly broken. They may not know exactly what it is. They may not know exactly what to do about it, but they are hungry for solutions.
Julia, I'm going to reframe that because she's not the only one who's not voting if the numbers are accurate. Could you talk a little bit about that problem, about the fact that Indiana does not fare well when it comes to voter participation?
Voter turnout in Indiana in 2014 was the worst in the country. So we haven't been doing well for a while, but to rank 50th is really a shameful statistic that everybody needs to be worried about. And we think that a big part of it, certainly not the only reason, turnout is complicated, but an awfully big reason is the tremendous number of uncompetitive and uncontested elections we have in Indiana. Currently, none of the 9 congressional districts are in play every 2 years. Those are all safe seats. It is predetermined who the congressional winner is going to be in all of the 9 districts in Indiana. That certainly doesn't help drive people to the polling place. Similarly, at the state Senate and state House level, 44 out of the 100 seats in 2014 for the Indiana House, there was only one candidate running. So it isn't really any wonder why a lot of Hoosiers stay home on Election Day, because frankly, voting, it doesn't significantly impact the outcome in too many districts in this state. That is directly related to incumbent politicians from the majority party drawing safe districts, protecting their incumbents. And so if we want vigorous contest in Indiana, if we want to increase voter turnout, we think the best way to do that is to end gerrymandering.
Robert, put this in a somewhat larger perspective for me, if you would. Is this specifically an Indiana problem, or is it something that is happening all across the country?
Well, I think the discussion about gerrymandering is a perennial one. I mean, the term itself comes from 1812, so it's more than 2 centuries old. And states have the prerogative to draw districts as they wish. And so this is a question that would be applicable to any of the 50 states we have. I don't want to be a contrarian, although I have a feeling that may be my role today. But It is deeply troublesome that there are 44 seats that went unopposed in the Indiana General Assembly last time. That, in its nature, would suggest that the electoral process is meaningless in that instance, the determining of who would hold that seat. But I don't know that that's a powerful predictor of why voter turnout was so low, because, for heaven's sake, if you got rid of all General Assembly elections, I don't think it would move the needle on voting behavior, because it tends to be driven by things that are much higher on the ballot. State legislative races are not strong motivators for voter turnout.
Well, I would add, shame on us, Tom. For that. And I think Bob makes a good point, but shame on us for that. It's true, gerrymandering's existed almost as long as our nation has. But when did we decide that it was okay for the politicians to behave in a way that suggests that they think these are their district, not districts, not ours? This is why this conversation is so important today, John, and it's why I know Julia shares this point of view. We feel like things may have finally gotten bad enough that people are prepared to take back their government and to focus on this thing. Politicians don't want us to talk about this. This, you know, we puff our chests and we get very proud of ourselves for taking away their perks. You know, we say you can't go to dinner with lobbyists anymore, and they can't give you gifts, and we think, by God, we've taught them a lesson. But we've left them their greatest perk of all, and that is their ability to design their own destiny. And they don't want us to talk about that. They like the cozy arrangement they have to go in the back room, lock the door, and slice and dice our state and communities. But it can stop. It has to stop, because people need to get mad enough about it to demand the change. There are ways to do this.
And Tom, I want to stick with you for a second, because you have been, you know, when you talk about those locked rooms or whatever where the decisions are being made, you've been part of that. I mean, you were a long-time staffer. Before you went to Lead or Leave, you were a long-time staffer for first Indiana governor and then U.S. Senator Evan Bayh. Can you talk about, you know, literally how this problem is viewed from the other side of the
well,
looking glass?
Yeah. To be absolutely clear, I've never been involved in any of this sort of activity, but certainly have suffered from the activity. Evan in the governor's office didn't design the districts. The legislature did those sorts of things. I worked before working for Evan Bayh. I worked for a congressman named Jim Johns in the 5th District in northern Indiana and became his chief of staff ultimately. His district was changed because of gerrymandering, and it caused him to lose an election. So I've seen firsthand. But what I've seen firsthand more than all of that, John, is the damage that's done when we create a government where politicians are actually punished for reaching across the aisle. When politicians in these very, very safe, manipulated districts, when they worry most about the outcome of their primary election, when people from – and both this is true in the Democratic and Republican parties – when the most partisan members of those parties are the ones who vote in primary elections, those are the folks that these politicians will pander to. And so you're rewarded to pander to the ideological extremes of your party. Mm-hmm. And then you go to a legislature, and today, because of unlimited campaign contributions, muscular groups like Club for Growth and others who threaten politicians for not following their political orthodoxy, that there is no upside to reaching mm-hmm. across the aisle. Evan made his reputation on building bipartisan bridges to get things done. But recently, when he looked at running for governor again, he said, no, thank you. It's too broken. We can't get anything done now. And that's the result of all that. So, yeah, do I know enough to know what's broken? You bet I do. But I also know enough about this to know what we need to do to change it.
And I should emphasize that he has said that on this show before himself, along with former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar, former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut, former Indianapolis Mayor Steve Goldsmith, in fact, all have said that the sort of rise of partisanship makes the process less responsive and also just far less fun.
And what I saw over and over again, John, is when these statesmen leave or lose, they're replaced by people that are generated from our politics today. More often than not, they're replaced by people who represent the ideological extremes of their party.
So I know, and I have been remiss in my homework. I'll acknowledge that to the audience here. I know that in the 2012 election, Julia or Robert, either one of you, I will throw this one to, that in the 2012 election, about 53.6% of the people in the state cast their ballots for Republicans in the Indiana House of Representatives, and that resulted somehow in Republicans getting 69% of the seats. What were the numbers like after the 2014 election? Julia, Robert, either one of you have those at your disposal?
Well, Republicans picked up a couple seats
in
the House,
and
I believe the baseline vote was something like 57% Republican. I think that shows further evidence that the maps have helped incumbent Republicans or Republican challengers dispose of Democratic incumbents. So clearly they've been designed to help the majority party, and they've worked.
Robert, go ahead, Robert.
The midterm election brings about a shrinking in the electorate, and so it's not surprising whatsoever that the baseline vote would be in the upper 50s the second time around compared to the presidential election. Any off-year election tends to have an electorate that's whiter and older and more Republican. So all elections are not always fully comparable. I want to say something completely off the wall for what it's worth.
Okay.
And that
show's
is
called
that,
No Limits for a reason.
There we go.
Okay.
The fundamental problem And the fundamental problem lies with districting itself, that is to say, territorial geographic constituencies. Other nations that don't use districting have a system known as proportional representation, and you have much, much more fidelity because in an area where 15% of the votes goes to the Green Party, they get 15% of the seats in the legislature. And you achieve that sort of reflection of the popular will that's much more faithful. But in order to get there, you would have to get rid of districts in the United States. And I don't know anybody who's clamoring for that sort of a change. And as a result, we're stuck with this ongoing notion that everybody lives in a district, and districts, by definition, deform and distort the ultimate outcome because of the way we award election outcomes to a system that's called winner-take-all. Somebody who gets 51% of the vote gets all of the power, and the 49% get exactly nothing. And so it tends to reward the winners, and that's what we saw in 2012. The 53% of the vote yielded an enormous supermajority in the legislature. But that's the nature of the districting process. It can't be fixed by redrawing the maps, because the fundamental problem is we have districts.
Well, and it's some of it, too. It also sort of warps the way we approach things. You see both parties in the years ending in zero, the election years ending in zero, really ramping their efforts up because they know they get to sort of shape the process for the next decade, Julia.
Well, I think that underscores the importance of politicians controlling their own destiny via the maps. And so if we really want to empower voters, we have to end gerrymandering. And the good news is that the glaze-over factor has lessened significantly in Indiana. I think there have been several wake-up calls, RFRA being a big one. I think that helped people understand the General Assembly is a lot more conservative than the rest of us.
We are talking today on No Limits about ways to make the political process more responsive. My guests are Tom Sugar, Julia Vaughn, and Robert Dion. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about ways that we can make the political process and the process of creating public policy more responsive and more reflective of the public it is supposed to serve. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Tom Sugar of leadorleave.org, Julia Vaughn of Common Cause, and Robert Dion, who is a political science professor with the University of Evansville. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey, Margaret. How are you?
Oh, my goodness. Thank you.
Certainly. Okay.
Okay. And thank you so much for this panel. It's so important what you're talking about. I'm going to focus on the how-to part of it for just basic citizens. My question is, I also have an opinion, of course.
Okay. Why don't you do the question first, Margaret, and then give us the opinion.
The question is, what steps are all three of you taking or your institutions to turn away from the political analysis of the parties and the winners and losers and turn around and outreach and talk to people in the grocery checkout line or walking your dog or waiting for the bus if you do that or waiting for your car to be delivered or at the office? Not so much about, I do agree that there's the glazed eye thing is on the verge of dropping if we can reach out and give people a sense of how to connect. One way is if you don't want to vote, still go ahead and volunteer as a citizen at the polling place. That's all set up by polls. I don't know how. I'm a fifth generation Hoosier, blah, 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 blah. But I, when I came back to Indiana, I'm still stunned that the Democratic and Republican parties control so much at the polling places. That those places should be filled as citizens, not political entities. But nobody knows that. So, again, my question is, what steps are your relative institutions and you within them taking to turn away from the fun political analysis part and look out and talk to regular people and let them know at the very least they can volunteer at the polls. They'll see how it works, and it's a starting point.
Margaret, I've seen Julia nodding her head up and down while you were talking, so I'm going to let her have the first crack.
Great.
Thank you very much for the question and the comments.
And I'll listen offline.
Great.
Thank you so very, very much. This is so critically important,
and
timing is critical.
Thank you.
Now, Margaret raises a important concern about partisan election administration. Certainly in Indiana, we actually have 92 different ways to administer elections because it's done by partisans at the county level. Unfortunately, at the state level, it would take legislation to change that, to make it more independent, and that's not something the General Assembly has been willing to discuss.
And Margaret raises, I think, in a larger term, an important question, which is sort of the reason we are all here, too, which is, okay, we now know where we are, and I don't think there's much satisfaction on, at least among all of, two-thirds of the panel. I understand, you know, Robert is taking a somewhat more detached view on this, but if we wanted to change things to make the system more responsive, what are the ways that we could go about doing that? Tom, I'm going to start with you.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's the critical question. There are really two components to this, it seems to me, John. There's the how do we design these districts, and you know, I think Bob is right. It'd be wonderful to go to sort of proportional process, but that's very, very unlikely. So we're going to have districts. So who's going to draw them, and what criteria will they use when drawing them? The more transparent the process, the better. I think the more involved citizens are in the process, the better. There are lots of ways we can slice and dice this, citizen commissions, independent commissions, and the like. But the process has to be transparent. It has to strengthen the voice of the people. What I focus most of my attention, though, on, John, is the criteria, because it really doesn't matter at the end of the day how elaborate or transparent your commission or the body that draws the lines. What matters most is how precise the law is when it comes to what criteria must be followed when designing the districts. And in my view, and that you can, I encourage your listeners to go to my website, leadorleave.org. I trumpet a plan that has been used very, very effectively since 1980 in Iowa, where they were essentially have removed all political considerations when drawing the maps. You cannot look at voter identification. You cannot look at voter performance. You can't even look at the incumbent's home address. You must only look at population and compactness, keeping cities and towns and counties together as best you can. And when you do that, when you actually apply a no-politics plan, as I like to call it, to the state of Indiana, you get more competitive districts, and you actually produce a legislature that looks a lot more like we do, with more Republicans than Democrats, sure. The state tends to be a little bit more that way. But a proportion of Republicans and Democrats and independents, which truly reflects the state. So it's the criteria that really matters. There's one other thing I want to add real quickly to Margaret's question. She said, what do we do about raising public awareness? One of our challenges, John, of course, is unlike many states, we don't have a ballot initiative process. So we can't, like they can in Ohio this November, put something on the ballot so people can say, by golly, I want this change. I want the districts back. I want this new approach to designing our legislature. So instead, we have to do things like we're doing today and build campaigns and raise this issue through campaign processes as best we can. And that's a little bit harder. I admit that.
Robert, right. Go ahead. I'm going to let you.
I agree with what was said. I was excited when the caller says, what do we do about this? Because that's the real, the money question is, now that we know the problem, how do we get there? And Tom's on the money with respect to how we proceed in the state. It's entirely up to the state legislature to decide how the drawing of lines takes place. It's their decision to make. We could change that if we want, but we'd have to change by my understanding, we'd have to change the Constitution, which would be a heavy lift. But if you can build the popular attention and the popular will to exert some pressure on these politicians to rethink it, then we're in a good place. And you know, honestly, I take my hat off to Jerry Torr and the others who've undertaken to have this study committee. And there's some really wonderful people on there: Ted Boehm and Sheila Kennedy and Tom Sugar, who have passion about this issue, and the lawmakers on there, I hope, will take the time to do a very thorough job of thinking through the kind of guidance we can get from other states. We can't follow necessarily the model of some states because of the way our system is set up, but the Iowa model, where that legislative services agency builds the plan and then it gets adopted by the legislature, is one that I think we could move to without having to fiddle with the Constitution.
Robert, and I should point out here that not every map that has disproportionate representation of one party or the other is the result of gerrymandering. I mean, there's some natural gerrymandering in that, you know, in Congress, for example, Wyoming is overwhelmingly Republican. They've got one seat and all of that. You're not going to have bipartisan system there. But if we were looking at fashioning a system that was more reflective of, you know, the state as a whole, and keeping in mind that most likely for political realities we will have to maintain districts,
right?
How would we go about doing that in your view as a scholar?
Oh boy, it is a real challenge because you know, we're constrained by the boundaries of the state. Living down here in Evansville, we're in the 8th district.
Mm-hmm.
You can fiddle around at the margins, but if a county is not in the 8th district, it's probably going to be in the 9th district, or it'll be further north or wherever. So there's only so much you can do, and the geographical, the spatial distribution of voters limits your ability to achieve that goal of proportional representation. There's all sorts of goals and criteria that one could use to draw lines, and the part is that very often those goals are incommensurable. So if your aim is to promote competitive elections, you may end up driving down contiguity. Or if your aim is to promote proportional representation of the overall voting patterns, you might end up diluting minority voting strength. So it's a challenge, and I would say that it's very clear that you can't come in with some sort of Procrustean, rigid formula that a computer imposes. You really do need a room full of thoughtful people engaging in deliberation in a complete system of transparency and wrestling with trying to optimize as much as one can all the things that would lead to what would appear to be a more fair distribution of district lines.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about ways that we can make both elections and the political process, the public policy process, more responsive and more reflective of the state as a whole. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what our regular listener Marion has done and give us reach out to us by email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Marion says, even voting, we vote against ourselves. Theoretically, elected officials work for those interested in profit, not the environment, ethics, or public welfare, while somehow artfully convincing a fearful public otherwise. Agribusiness, specifically livestock producers, rule the Indiana State House and rural communities. 2% of our population farms for government-supported corporate food giants obeying destructive industry-dictated land usage and animal care practices. Can Leader Leave or Common Cause help the relentless expansion of livestock production of Indiana, specifically the construction expansion of confined animal feeding operations and smaller unregulated CFOs in our most vulnerable communities? And again, that was Marion. I'll start with Julia on that one. And Marion, after Julia answers your specific question, I'm going to take the liberty of expanding it here.
Well, ag policy is not an issue that we work on directly, but I think that Marion's concern speaks to the bigger issue that, you know, big ag has control of agriculture policy inside the General Assembly, despite the fact that they actually represent a very small number of Hoosiers. Again, that goes back to districts that are drawn to, for partisan interests rather than the public interest.
Well, and I think what I'd like to do is talk about what this does to the process itself, the kind of entree that having these basically non-competitive races and a non-competitive process gives to not just agribusiness, big agribusiness, but all sorts of single issue or special interest groups. You know, we mentioned RFRA and some of the other issues that have popped up that realistically probably were not on the top priority, wouldn't have been near the top of the priority list for most Hoosiers. Tom, can you speak to that a
yeah.
little bit?
Well, you know, RFRA is a great example, actually. A highly motivated minority, and legislators knew that those are the folks who are most inclined to vote in their primaries, threatened them. And it's extraordinary, John, when you think about it, because in this case, and there are cases that involve the Democratic Party, too. I'm not being partisan about this. But in this case, the Republicans, the rank-and-file Republicans in the legislature ignored what most would argue would be one of their most important constituencies, which is, you know, corporations, business leaders, the Chamber of Commerce, all who warned them that this would be destructive to our economy to go down this path. And still they did. Why? Because they feared most the people who were absolutely certain to walk across broken glass to vote in those primaries and vote them out on this very, very charged social issue. And so they did what they did. And then, you know, we couldn't, because of supermajorities, John, even if the Democrats felt differently about it, they couldn't say time out, walk out, cause everybody to, you know, have a moment of reflection before jumping off this cliff, because they don't even have to show up for action to take mm-hmm. place in a supermajority situation. So the checks and balances have really been lost. And before I turn over the microphone, I want to add one little quick thing to what Bob was saying. The congressional gerrymandering is a horrible, horrible situation in Indiana. As Julia said, we have no competitive districts. And here's the thing that really burns me up. There are 8 counties in our state that are divided between congressional districts solely for the purposes of rigging the outcome of the election. When you apply this Iowa-like no-partisan plan to the state, only one county has to be divided, and that's Marion, because there's so many people who live here. And in that case, Bob, your 8th district, which is currently 63% or 60% Republican, if you just kept whole counties together and redrew them based on the no politics plan, would become a 51% Republican district, and that would be a competitive district. So that's sort of just keeping counties intact can lead us to much better outcomes in terms of our congressional representation.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Reed, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Reed says, the most effective way for voters to reclaim their power and improve our options would be to change our electoral system from the current first-past-the-post system, the oldest form from the 1400s, to the single transferable vote, and that's from the 1800s. Probably, Robert, we ought to explain what that means. Since you were chiming in there, you indicate that you know what he's talking about.
I'm very pleased that he said that. There's all sorts of ways that a person can register his or her preferences with respect to a range of candidates, and especially in a crowded field like the Republican presidential primary right now. The vote in itself is such a blunt instrument. If you just say, I'm for Carly Fiorina, you can't really reflect the people who are a very close second or whatnot. A single transferable vote allows for a person to register his or her preference down the ballot. And as a result, if the first person your first choice doesn't get the most votes or a majority, then it transfers to the next person on the list. And what ends up happening is the person who ultimately wins is a much, much more faithful reflection of the overall preference profile of the voting electorate. So it's a technique that sounds more complicated than it is. It's used in countries like Ireland, for example, and they're very happy with it, because that way a person doesn't have to cast in stone a one-sided expression. He or she can say, you know, out of these 4 candidates, here's my ranking, and it all goes into the mix, and what comes out is the person who is the most appealing to the most people.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about ways to make the political process and elections more responsive and reflective of the public they are supposed to serve. My guests are Tom Sugar, who is with LeadOrLeave.org, Julia Vaughn of Common Cause, and talking with us from Evansville is Robert Dian, who is with the Political Science Department with the University of Evansville. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about ways that we can make the political process more responsive and reflective to and of the public it's supposed to serve. My guests are Tom Sugar of LeaderLeave.org, Julia Vaughn, who is with Common Cause, and talking with us from Evansville is Robert Dian, who's a political science professor at the University of Evansville. We've gotten an email from a listener named Brett, who asks a simple question. If you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Brett asks, what's wrong with using county boundary lines? Tom, I'll throw that one your way.
Yeah, no, it's a very, very good point. I think that the new criteria that we develop should do its best to keep counties intact. As I made the point earlier, right now, there are 8 counties in Indiana that are divided in congressional districts between 2 congressional districts solely for the purpose of ensuring the outcome of an election. By taking the politics out and doing our best to not cross boundaries like city, town, and county lines, we can have a beautiful map that keeps every county intact for the congressional districts except Marion County, which has too many people in it. So you would remove from that district the southern part of the county, the townships there, and push them south, and we'd have a perfect map. So it's absolutely doable and produces an outcome that looks a lot more like Indiana. In this case, there would be competitive districts for Congress, where now there are none. We would have 4 competitive districts. And 3 would probably be safe Republican and 2 safe Democrat.
We've also gotten another email question from a listener named Jeffrey. And Jeffrey, I'm going to take the liberty of boiling this down. Says, Tom, referring to you, the panelist that was working with the Evan Bayh administration, wasn't trumpeting this issue when they were in power. And basically the argument is that winners tend not to complain about the process that brings them to power.
Yeah, no, that's a very, very good point, Jeffrey. And you're right. Shame on us. We should have. But here's the situation a governor finds him or herself in. You need to get legislation through the legislature. And so it usually isn't very wise to say to the legislature, you know what I'm going to do now? I'm going to take away your greatest perk and then we'll do business. Mike Pence was asked about this issue in Fort Wayne at a recent town meeting just about a month ago. He was asked the question twice, actually, and both times he punted, saying, well, you know, I don't really have anything to do with that. That's up to the legislature, which is true. But I would say this. It is a failure of leadership for governor candidates and governors to stay silent on this. Evan should have spoken up. He now looks at the situation and says, I don't want to run for governor ever again because it's so broken. He should have spoken up then. Mike Pence should speak up now. John Gregg should be speaking up about this. It's the only way in a state where we don't have a ballot initiative to really get the change we desire.
Robert or Julia, I'm going to throw this to either one of you. Has there been a change in gerrymandering? Because the other part of Jeffrey's question that I didn't get to is, he says, human nature hasn't changed all that much the past 150 years. There's always been a will to do this. Is part of the difference now the technology involved?
Oh.
They used to refer to gerrymandering as a dark art.
Right.
Now it's more of
it's
a dark science.
It's an exact science.
Yeah.
I think, as you know, Tom has said, this is not your grandfather's gerrymandering. The GIS software is so precise. I mean, you can X out individual candidates from a map if you want to. So I think the proof is in the pudding. And let me be clear, Common Cause Indiana has been championing this issue for decades. Amen. And so we're not newcomers to
Absolutely.
This. And whichever party is in power, we complained about them because they have both been guilty of gerrymandering. But clearly, in 2011, the software enabled Republicans, and, you know, we heard this at the study committee last week, but our districts are so compact. They're just so pretty. They're nice, regular shapes. Well, that really isn't any indication of gerrymandering. You can have gerrymandered districts that are regularly shaped and nice compact squares. It's very easy today to draw pretty maps that are indeed gerrymandered, and that's what we've got in Indiana.
Robert, could you put this in some sort of historical perspective for us? I mean, as Jeffrey suggests accurately, gerrymandering's been around now. We just celebrated its 200th anniversary a couple of years ago. But is it different now because of the precision with which those maps can be drawn?
Well, computers have changed everything about modern campaigning. We've got micro-targeting. We used to think it was fancy to send direct mail pieces off of a computerized list, but now there's such fine-grained abilities to target messages and to deliver messages during campaigns, and that same information can be translated to the districting question. So there's an enormous amount of precision today that allows for perhaps more mischief to take place. Julia's exactly right about that. One other thing that has not changed is what Tom was suggesting, which is that this is fundamentally a political question. It has to be decided by the Indiana State Legislature. They have to be induced to want to revisit the way that districts are drawn. We can't expect the courts to help us because of a famous landmark Indiana-based case that went to the Supreme Court in 1986, which said partisan gerrymandering may be unpleasant for the minority party, but it is flatly not unconstitutional, and we will not help you. And so the Supreme Court has a long-standing stance that says these are political questions that need to be decided by political officials. And as the questioner says quite correctly, it's awfully hard to convince a winner, someone who's the beneficiary, to undo those advantages and make themselves more vulnerable.
We are talking about ways to make elections and the political process more responsive, competitive, and reflective of the state as a whole. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Richard has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Isn't there a simple solution to this? By just taking you have to have a certain population in a district. But why can't you just take that population, draw a square around it, and that's a district? And then you just continue that process throughout the state, and where the district lines fall, that's where they fall, and that's who's included in the district. And that way, you could not have rectangular districts that included Fort Wayne and Indianapolis, so that would get rid of the gerrymandering aspect and just go at it that way and let the votes fall where they may.
Thanks very much for calling the question, Richard. Should point out that that's actually how the term gerrymander came about, is that he drew a district that looked like a salamander,
right.
And that's where the joke came from. While Richard was talking, I saw Julia nodding her head up and down and Tom shaking his head back and forth. So I'm going to let Julia have the first crack and then Tom, because I suspect there's some disagreement.
Well,
there.
It's a little bit more complicated than just drawing squares. Number one, you might run afoul of the Voting Rights Act, particularly in urban areas.
Or the Ohio River in some
cases. You run the risk when you just, you know, go by geometry of packing minority voters into districts. And that is illegal. deal. Professor Diane talked about they're not interested in lawsuits involving partisan gerrymandering, but the Supreme Court is absolutely interested in cases involving racial gerrymandering. So there's a number of different criteria. Tom's right. It's the who and it's the how. It's we need an independent body of citizens to take charge of redistricting. We've got to take it away from the most self-interested people doing it. And then we have to have a list of ranked criteria. Professor Dion's right. You can't have districts that are equal population, compact, respect the Voting Rights Act, induce competition, and respect communities of interest equally. We are going to have to rank which of those criteria are the most important. Some of them aren't negotiable. Equal population is going to have to be at the top of the list, followed by respect for the Voting Rights Act. But then it's up to Hoosiers. We need to demand that our legislatures change this, and we've got to take part in the discussion of which of those criteria we think are the most important.
Tom, I see you now nodding your head.
Well,
up and down.
I don't think there's much of a difference in our opinion, but I will add real quickly as an example for Richard.
Yeah.
If we applied Richard's approach and just drew squares, we wouldn't get an outcome which I really like in my maps. This is one example: a state senate district which only includes the populations of West Lafayette and Lafayette. And most people would argue that those communities have a lot in common. This is where we get into this communities of interest idea. And if you looked at that, the design of that map, it looked like some kind of animal because you're following the city lines.
Right.
That doesn't mean it's a bad map, but it certainly creates a community where a single senator would represent the interests of West Lafayette and Lafayette, and that would be his or her focus. And that makes sense to me.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Daniel who says, "My barber contends we vote incumbents out, not that we vote people into office. Considering Indiana's low voting rates and what was experienced with RFRA, has the contention been validated?" Robert, I'm going to throw that one your way.
You know, the barber is onto something. There's a very eminent political scientist who's gone now, V.O. Key, who wrote in the 40s that public opinion tends not to be very focused or precise, but Americans are very good at telling you what they don't like. He called this idea opinion dikes. If you move too far beyond the bounds of reasonable thought or action, you will hear a backlash from the public. I think RFRA was a good example of that. And the same is true with incumbents. The default is that the incumbent has an enormous advantage until such time as he or she strays from what the people want for whatever reason, and then we vote those people out. Every election, I think, is more characterized by a referendum on the performance of the incumbent as opposed to what we call that retrospective voting as opposed to prospective voting, which is a carefully reasoned, fully informed examination of the two or more competing candidates. Most people are just saying, I like this guy and I want more, or I don't like this guy and I don't want any more of that.
Becky, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
My question is, can I go ahead with my question?
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm just wondering why we're not looking at the quality of the candidate as a person more so than the district that they live in or who they represent, because they really represent us. I would like to see on the application to apply for candidacy at every level, a questionnaire as to what kind of service have they volunteered for, what military service have they done, what are their credentials, what is their temperament. The kinds of questions that make a difference in caring about the individuals that shows up in a questionnaire type thing in their application, so that the voters know the quality of the person rather than the quantity of their money. How can we do that?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Becky. Well, if I can simplify this a little bit, and I'll throw this one Julia's way. I mean, is there a way that we could, in fact, make elections like job applications and have the voters say, okay, this is what we're looking for? How
Yeah, the lack of good information, you know, I was at a public forum earlier this week, and I heard the same complaint. How are voters supposed to make up their mind? I guess, you know, my first concern is that we actually have a choice to make and we get rid of gerrymandering. So we do actually have at least two candidates to choose from. You know, it's the professionalism of politics. It's, you know, any political consultant worth their salt's going to tell candidates, don't debate, don't fill out those candidate surveys. You don't want to, you know, step into anything. And so I think as voters, we just have to express our dissatisfaction with that. We have to, when we get the opportunity to interact with candidates, we need to let them know that's a problem for us.
Tom. And this is, gerrymandering has a connection here too, and I know Julia agrees with this, and that is, you know, increased competition, right?
Right.
So when the districts are not gerrymandered, and you're a citizen, a person who volunteers in your community, feels like he or she can make a good case for becoming a representative, and you look at that district and go, you know what? I got a fair chance to run and win this thing. But when they're so rigged, and you can see it's impossible to beat the incumbent in the other party because of the way the district is drawn, you just don't even try.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Jerry, regular listener named Jerry, says the gerrymandering in Indiana is a reflection of the character or lack of it, of its populace and politicians. What is that? I guess I'll reframe that a little bit, Jerry. What does that say about the fact that we have the kind of system we do say about the state? We've got about a minute and a half left, so I'm going to give each one of you 30 seconds, and I'm going to start with Robert.
Well, it is pretty pitiful. We get the political system we deserve. We have so much power in our hands as voters on Election Day to deny our vote or to cast our vote, and we need to flex that muscle as opposed to withdrawing from the system, and that's why we need groups like the League of Women Voters and Common Cause to get out and evangelize and inspire people, because at the end of the day, in a democratic system, voters have all the power, and we need to flex that muscle.
Tom, 30 seconds.
We're about to celebrate our bicentennial, John, and there's no better time than right now to reflect on what kind of state we are and what kind of government we want. As Bob said, it's all about power being in the hands of the people. In fact, our Constitution proclaims that in its opening words. All power is inherent in the people. Hopefully, this bicentennial year, next year, we'll take that power back and remind politicians these districts are ours, not theirs.
Okay. Julia, you get the last word.
Thank you. We have an incredible opportunity with the Special Study Committee on Redistricting, but, you know, it's going to be tough. The states that have significantly reformed redistricting did it directly through the ballot initiative. So we've got to get those folks who benefit the most from gerrymandering to give it up. That obviously isn't going to happen without a tremendous amount of citizen pressure. So I would encourage folks to pay attention to this discussion.
And I would like to thank all three of you. I'd like to thank my guests, Tom Sugar, Julia Vaughn, and Robert Dyan, for what has been a really lively and, I think, informative conversation. I've enjoyed talking with all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for being here. I would also like to thank our listeners for sending in some great questions and comments and elevating this conversation still further. And I would like to invite you all to come back next Tuesday, when I'll be talking with former United States Senator John Danforth about his book, The Relevance of Religion, How Faithful People Can Change Politics. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.